This week we're being asked again to reflect on the epidemic of domestic violence and not flinch, not turn away. In Victoria yesterday, the findings of the Royal Commission were presented to the Andrews government. And today we're going to meet one Victorian woman, Ruth Clare, who has a harrowing story of her own. The lead character in her horror story was her father, who learned his extreme violence in the jungles of Vietnam. Ruth thought that was just who he was, until she met other veterans of the Vietnam War and came to understand why. Her memoir is called Enemy, and she grew up almost waiting for enemy attack. She joins me now, and please be aware this story will have content that's not suitable for young ears. Ruth, good morning to you.
Hi, Ellen.
Do what Dad says within 5 seconds or what, Ruth?
Well, it depended on the day, really, but it could be a poke in the back or yelling in your face, or it could explode into something a bit more.
I read the first part of your book and I kept picking it up, and it was so compelling and I had to keep putting it down, and I read all the way through. There was a Tic Tac sticker on the wall. What happened when he found that?
Well, that was actually my first memory, and it was when I was 3 years old. And it's actually probably the most vivid memory I have from my whole childhood, because it was so frightening, the scale of the attack that happened at that time. So I was playing a game underneath a table, and Dad's legs stopped in front of me, and I heard him have this sharp intake of breath, which I set off my alarm system straight away, because I knew that that meant something might be happening. And he called Kirsten and I.
Your sister?
Kirsten, yeah. And he said, I kept hiding underneath the table, and eventually he dragged me. I said, I'm here. And he dragged me out and said, who stuck the Tic Tac sticker on the wall? And my 3 year old reasoning, I thought, well, if I don't own up to it, then I can't get in trouble for it. And so my sister said, I didn't, which was the truth. And I said, I didn't, which was a lie. And so he hit us both. And
He beat you. I mean, he took his arm and bashed you across the ear. He knocked you senseless.
Yeah, yeah.
And it didn't stop there.
No, so eventually I owned up to it, and that's when he really started hitting me. And he had this thing that he would sometimes get into, where he would use your body like a drum and beat his words, but use your body
and beat you
to make
each
a point.
Word. I don't want you, etc.
That's it. And this particular time was so scary, because I kept running away from him, and then he kept dragging me out of the places I tried to hide. And this one moment, I was underneath the couch and he pulled me up by the leg, and I was dangling upside down. And, you know, just that experience of being in your own head, I don't know, everything's blurring around you as well. So that was, you know, apart from the pain, it was discombobulating. And so, you know, it felt so terrifying.
And you write that at some point you ceased to register the pain, and it was it just became about survival, getting under something before that hand could grab your ankle and pull you back out.
Yep, that's right.
What was Mum doing at that point? She was in the house.
Yeah, she was in the house. It's interesting. Mum just doesn't feature in most of those memories at all. I never looked for her, and so I wasn't always sure what she was doing. Sometimes I might see her standing just frozen in terror. She was frozen. Anytime I did see her, it was like a rabbit in the headlights, that type of the held breath and just trying not to make a move.
At the end of that incident with the Tic Tacs, you describe her coming into the room and saying, you're going to kill these girls, stop it.
Yep.
And he did.
Yeah. Yep. That happened a few times, where he would lose complete control and Mum would eventually find her voice. But she was so frightened, and that even when she was speaking, you could hear she was trying to yell, and her voice was so tight with terror that she could barely get out more than a whisper. So it was a miracle that she was actually heard.
Mm. And tell me, how regular was this? You describe almost a childhood as a state of siege with the enemy from the title of your book. How common were these attacks?
Well, I think what happened was it started off really, you know, and I know from having had kids myself, the erraticness of their behaviour and their, you know, defiance and willfulness and all of the things that, you know, was a normal developmental stage. It starts off, you know, around that two period of time to when they're around seven. That was the most intense period of violence, because we weren't capable of reining in our behaviour to the degree he needed it to be reined in.
But you also describe just lying on your bed, staring at the curtains, hoping that if you just disappeared, it would stop.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was, and that was the other thing, is that you would never, so I spent a lot of time just lying on my bed, making up stories and reading or making up stories. But then that might be something that annoyed him on a day, because he spent his childhood out, you know, in the yard doing, you know, digging or something. And so that was what he would, you know, it was lazy to be lying there.
We'll come to his experiences in Vietnam and how you came to understand that informed some of his behaviour. We'll come to that just in a moment. But we're talking this week about domestic violence. And you describe a scene where he attacks your mother.
Mm.
You run to the elderly neighbour
to
call for the police. And later the police come. And both those individuals, both those adults you go to for help, the police and the elderly neighbour, they just flinch. They just want to look away in the end. They help, but they say, how's school, love? What's that about?
Yeah, I think that's still somewhat common in the, you know, like when an ambulance driver comes out to a scene and, you know, like I've had an incident with my daughter being unconscious, you know, and they're immediately kind of trying to joke about it. You know, I can understand, especially with the police, it's a kind of resilience thing to demonstrate that you're okay. I can see why that strategy of, you know, it's all right, we're all normal. You know, it feels like you can see that they're not, you know, it's probably not the time for them to try and have an in-depth psychological discussion about the, you know, impact of that moment on your life.
But what impact did that have on you when you're thinking, this is serious, I've gone to the adults, I've gone to the police, and everybody's making chit-chat?
Yeah, I mean, it's always flabbergasted me. I've always been somebody who kind of wants to talk about the stuff that happened, and I think most people I've spoken to are like, okay, yep, so what's on the telly? And I've always wanted to have those conversations. I think it's part of the society we live in that a lot of people just don't want to talk about it.
Does it make a difference to talk about it?
To me, it absolutely does, and it's one of the reasons that I have shared my story, is that I read a lot of memoir because I love hearing people's own views on their lives, and I spent my whole life looking for any of these themes to be, you know, the child of a veteran, because it's not just a child of a Vietnam veteran. It's if your parent has PTSD or has war trauma, the experience of, you know, growing up with a World War I father or a World War II father is the same as a Vietnam veteran father in a lot of really significant ways. And also this notion of domestic violence isn't restricted to a man hitting his wife and the children are passive victims by watching that and feeling helpless. Children are direct victims of physical violence from their parents. And I don't think that conversation has actually been had yet. I've not heard it really discussed, that it's not that the women are always just getting hit. The children are getting hit too. And the children are suffering.
And what impact did that have on you, on your sense of yourself and your own self-esteem?
I thought the way that Dad was with me meant that I was deeply unlovable. That because there was no sense to the way his behaviour. I couldn't figure it out. I tried to figure out what the rules were and I could not make sense of them. And so the only constant in that situation was me. I mean, it happened to my brother and sister also, but in my relationship with Dad, I was the thing that was always wrong. I was the thing that was always in trouble. So I was the thing that was damaged and worthy of that sort of punishment.
And did he talk about the war?
Very rarely. Very rarely. It, you know, probably came up off-the-cuff remarks sometimes, maybe 20 times in the whole time he lived with us.
And what did he say? Might have,
if there was something on television, he really didn't like America, and he had a lot of anti-American sentiment based on, I think there was part of him that blamed America for their involvement in the war. So he didn't like the way that we were sliding toward being more, less focused on being, following English.
So nothing personal, nothing personal. He'd just reflect in that way. And when did you first understand the connection between this extreme violence and his war experiences?
Really not until, I mean, I even had it. Even had a real inkling of it until I was pregnant with my daughter in 2007. So that was when I first started. I had all these, you know, warm, gushy feelings toward my baby growing inside and just thinking, what about if this is how he felt when he was, and it somehow it's genetic or...
I do the same thing.
What about if this is how it starts out and something then happens? Oh. And so I guess I wanted it. I wanted to find an answer that wasn't that. And so I thought that, you know, I had been in therapy for a long time and I'd talked about it and my therapist said a lot of this is a very common experience. So that made me think I want to know what it was like for them so that I could, you know, have some more compassion for my dad.
And compassion, that's interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, even though he was dead for a long period of time, that I didn't like, I carried around a huge amount of rage at him and that lives inside me, you know. I thought, screw that, I'm going to beat him. I'm going to not have to feel this level of rage every time I think of him. I'm going to find some way around that. And for me, it's always been that, you know, it's not excusing behaviour, but if I can, I wanted to have, I don't know, some distance from that amount of rage. And for me, it needed to be about understanding. And understanding, I think, always, you know, develops into compassion.
You came to understand that it was his training and it was what he had gone through in Vietnam that contributed to this behaviour. And you, before he died, when you were 24, long before you had children, you confronted him about it all. What did he say?
Well, it was when I was 18 that I confronted him. I'd been up to Rockhampton for a visit and I visited my sister, but I didn't even think to visit Dad. And of course, as fate would have it, he came and basically sprung me at Kirsten's house. And even then I still didn't think, oh, well, I better make a phone call and go and see him. It just didn't occur to me. He wasn't really making any effort with me, so I just figured, whatever. And he called me and he had this little hurt voice and he said, I'm so disappointed you didn't come to see me. And I lost my mind at him. I said, how dare you be angry at me? Do you remember when you hit me when I was two? Do you remember when you did this? Do you remember dragging me? And I started listing incident after incident after incident. And he said, no, I don't remember that. And I just went, I could not believe that could be the case.
Did you ever come to accept that was true? I mean, could that be true? Because when Mum said, stop it, you'll kill them, he heard her. He wasn't drunk, he heard her.
Yeah. Yeah, I've spoken to a lot of different psychologists over the years about the nature of disassociation and whether or not this could be the truth. And there's this, you know, it's what I think is interesting is that when somebody has been in a war experience, it's often not that when they've been injured that is the most traumatic things, it's when they've done the harm to other. Psychologically, that's a bigger boundary to cross.
But it also means that you're the one who has to carry it all. He doesn't carry any of the burden of those memories.
Yeah, that sucked, pretty much. Because, you know, ultimately I think, you know, that sense of justice, you want the person to stand up and say, I did do that and I should not have done it and I'm sorry for doing it. And if they say they don't remember doing it, where do you go with that?
And where do you go? He died before you could ever resolve that. What do you do with that?
Have a truckload of therapy. So, you know, there's, for me, what happened was that I did, you know, you get to say it to the chair and pretend dad and, you know, you do all that sort of stuff, which always sounds a bit embarrassing when you talk about it. But, you know, it's those moments can, you know, it's about being heard in some way and about being acknowledged. And it can't always happen from the parent. It doesn't mean you don't get to, you know, I think there are things you can do for yourself to allow yourself to feel heard.
Being heard and being acknowledged and writing a book. Thank you so much for telling us about it, Ruth.
Thanks.
That was Ruth Clare and her book is Enemy. And it's published by Penguin Viking. You're listening to Life Matters.